Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every weekend right here. Each week we visit with veterans, mostly from the World War II generation. The idea is to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and along the way be educated and inspired by members of our greatest generation. We call it Hometown Heroes because no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small it might be, there are heroes around you. There are people that have done a lot more than you realize, endured things that maybe you can't even imagine for the sake of our freedom. And no one knows the value of freedom more than those who have had to live without freedom, live in captivity. That's the case today with an ex-prisoner of war that we're going to hear from. 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California is our guest. And I say Bakersfield, California, you've been here a long time, but you grew up in a much colder climate. What was it like growing up in Duluth, Minnesota?
Well, Duluth was a great place to grow up. All sorts of weather and all sorts of things that young kids could do. Skating, skiing, baseball, football, you name it. We could do it. It was a great place to grow up.
Especially with three older brothers who could show you the ropes. You were the youngest of four?
Yes.
And you actually signed up for the military long before Pearl Harbor. When did you first get involved in the service?
Well, I joined the National Guard in Duluth in August of 1936. I was 16 years old, and obviously I had to lie about my age. But that was a great experience. We had summer camps and weekly meetings, and it was a great experience.
So that was your first exposure. And how was it that you aimed toward getting up in the sky and flying a little bit? Did you fly at an early age? Did you see someone else? What got your attention with aviation?
When I was in the Guard, one of my closest friends there was a boy 2 or 3 years older than I that was interested in flying. And he got his flying license when he was about 19 years old, and when he hit 20, 21, he joined the Air Force. So about a year before I did, and that was the sort of inspiration to get me to do the same thing.
I'm sure you remember the first time you got up in the air. Do you remember what that felt like? A new feeling for you, I imagine.
My first experience flying was a CAA program that the government ran, I think, particularly to start some initial early training for feeling that the war was going to come and we were going to get involved. So this was in the summer of 1940, and I ended up getting 40 hours of flying time and getting my pilot's license. Could have gone on with that program for another session, but in the meantime, I applied for the Air Force, and I had orders to join the Air Force there in October of 40, so I obviously passed up the other training. I ended up going to Minneapolis, the army base there, and the six we're talking about were from all over, some from Minnesota, some from the Dakotas, and we all ended up going on a train together and ended up in Oxnard, California as a primary training base.
During the course of all this training, I know it's exciting to be up in the air and experience things you've never experienced before, but were there some challenges along the way? Were there some parts of the training or the studies that you found difficult or tough to get through?
No, not really. I had the fact that I had the 40 hours and a pilot's license before I got there really made an astounding bit of difference. I had no problem. I really enjoyed every bit of the training programs, both, you know, basic and the advanced. It was a great experience.
So as you're progressing along in the training and the flying, did you think about what planes you wanted to fly? Was there some debate in your mind over whether fighters or multi-engine planes would be preferable?
Not particularly. I probably initially felt that I wanted to get into fighters, but, you know, when the training was over with and I was ended up being assigned to the B-17 training, well, You know, that was it. I was happy with it. It was a good training program, and of course I ended up flying every variety of the B-17, including the G that I got shot down in.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, they hear B-17, and they have a picture in their mind, and they're all the same. But they weren't all the same. There are a lot of different iterations. Did you have a favorite among the bunch?
Well, the best, of course, was the G, which had the chin turret. The C model was a really early version. It did not have a tail gun. Pretty limited from the standpoint of fighting off anybody else. I'm not sure if the D model had a tail gun or not, but I think it had it was the first one with the lower turret. And then the F model had the upper turret, and I think it had the bottom turret as well as the tail gun.
And they all flew about the same for you? Did they feel the same up in the air?
Oh, pretty much the same. I think the G had a little bit stronger engines than the other, but it was also a heavier airplane, so they all flew about the same.
And having spent as much time as you did and training other people to fly them, what was your opinion on how easy that plane was to fly? Did it take some special skills to handle that big of an airplane, or did you find it fairly simple and straightforward?
Well, I thought it was real easy to fly, probably because I had so much time in it. But it was not a difficult airplane to fly at all. Very easy to control. So it's a great airplane.
And you alluded to getting shot down. We'll get to that. But chronologically speaking, even still before Pearl Harbor and America's official entrance into the war, you were stationed at Moffett Field, which is up in the Bay Area, where they still have the big blimp hangars. The lighter-than-air program was going up there. And what was it that sent you down to a fateful trip to the Bakersfield area?
Well, the weather was lousy. This is in January of 41. We just couldn't get any flying time in, so we ended up coming down to Bakersfield in order to get some flying time in and finished the basic down here. Winterfield, I think, was, in fact, it didn't even exist at that time. So we flew out of Meadows Field.
But while you were down here, something else happened that would change your life a little bit. How did you meet your wife?
Well, there was a group of women in Bakersfield that gave periodic dances and get-togethers for the cadets, and then invited, of course, various local girls. And that's where I met my wife.
Well, what was it that caught your eye? Was it the name? Was it the hair? Was it the smile? What do you remember about that?
Oh, it was the look and the smile and everything else. And she always contended that when I and a couple of other guys were walking over to her, she says, "I'm going to take the one in the middle." And that was me.
She had her sights on you. But you weren't here for very long at that time, right?
No, we were just here for a few weeks, about 6 weeks. And we ended up going back to Stockton for the advanced flying before I graduated.
And when you went back up to Stockton, were you thinking you'd ever see her again?
Yes, because I was at Stockton. Fresno is, you know, about an hour's drive away. So I had a couple of dates with her during that 6 weeks at Stockton. But when that was over with, I had no idea I'd ever see her again. But of course, I ended up being my first assignment out of there was as an instructor, so I ended up back at, by this time, Mentor Field. Obviously, then I had a chance to see her again. She was in her final year at Fresno State.
Yeah, she was a Bulldog. You know, before I forget, I know we're bouncing around time-wise now, but Central California also figured into how you experienced December 7th, 1941. And I like to ask every veteran about Pearl Harbor Day. I've heard a lot of stories, but never had anyone who was where you were at that time. You were going from Bakersfield to San Francisco with an old girlfriend from Minnesota, and you took a little detour through a national park.
On the way, we got the notice that the president was giving a speech, and we were in Yosemite at the time and pulled over the road and listened to the talk from the president about the beginning of the war.
What did that mean to you? I'm sure there are a lot of things going through your mind at that point.
Well, at that point, the name of the game was to finish driving to San Francisco and dropping off the girl, Minerva. And then I turned around, drove back to Bakersfield.
Did you notice a change in the urgency at that point, now that America was at war?
Well, there was a little bit of increase in the urgency. I'm not sure if we were flying 6 days a week before that, but they juiced up the cadet program training, going a little faster. and probably cut the program by a week or two. And we ended up flying 6 days a week instead of five as instructors. And, you know, that was basically the biggest change.
And we're going to get to the missions you flew, including your last mission and all of that. But have you ever tried to look back and estimate how many other pilots you trained? How many guys went overseas relying on the training they got from you?
Oh, there was a lot. When I got through the B-17 training schedule in the summer of 42, I ended up as an instructor in the B-17 program and ended up doing that for, until the spring of 44. I don't know, I must have trained a couple hundred different pilots and crews, a lot of them. I ended up at Gulfport as a squadron commander. By that time, a squadron, training squadron, had probably 25 or 30 pilots, an equal number of navigator, bombardier instructors, and gunnery instructors, and the whole thing. I ended up as commander of a couple different squadrons of that before I ended up getting orders overseas.
And those orders overseas, are those something that you had kind of hoped for, waited for you? Were you satisfied with what you were doing domestically, or was there part of you that was itching to get over and fight this enemy?
Well, I was happy with what I was doing, but I knew that, right about the time that I was going to end up with orders overseas. So I was sort of looking forward to it, a little apprehensive at the same time, because my wife was with me, and I was sure she wasn't going to be very happy, but you know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to get to, because a lot of guys decided to get married before they went over, and others said, you know what, let's wait and make sure I actually get back before we do that. Did you guys hem and haw about that at all, or are you just ready to seal the deal and get married before you headed over?
No, we were pretty well set. It had to be in February of 43 that I proposed. Then we got married in that summer.
So what was that like for you to head overseas and leave behind this bride, hoping that you made it back someday?
Well, it was something that I knew was inevitable. Something that you knew was coming and inevitable. It was a little more difficult for her, of course, than it was for me.
And I imagine you carried some items that might remind you of her as you headed off.
Yeah, I had a picture of her with me, which I kept all the time. And when I was a POW, I had it pinned up on the wall next to my bed. I had that picture with me until somebody stole my billfold here a few years ago and never got the picture back.
Boy, that makes everybody angry. That's just despicable. There's some things that are worth a lot more than money, and that's one of them. What about the guys that you went over with? Did you have a crew established before you actually got overseas and flew your first mission? Did you know who was going to be aboard your plane?
No. I had been an instructor so for a long time. So when I went overseas, I went over on the premise that I would take over as a squadron commander. Because what was happening is as people got 25 missions, they went home. And it only took about 6 months to get 25 missions in, so they were lacking people with a fair amount of experience. So they put together a whole group of majors and lieutenant colonels who had been in the training business for a long time, sent us all over to become squadron commanders with a little bit more experience than the other guys would have.
But they told you, before we can make you a squadron commander, you've got to fly five missions first? Is that what they said?
Yes. The premise was that the five missions were to get oriented with the program, the briefing, the crews, and everything like that, so that by the time you took over as a squadron commander, you had some experience in the area, got to know the crews, got to know the people. So that was the premise of the five missions.
So on your sixth mission, you were to take over as squadron commander. But let's talk about your first mission. Do you remember what that felt like to head off on an actual mission with an actual target and 10 guys on your plane that you were just getting to know?
Well, yes, it was a pretty unique experience, obviously. But you were so busy, flying the airplane, handling the crew, getting in formation, staying in formation, and getting prepared to go to the target that, you know, you didn't think too much about it.
And you were flying out of where, England?
Yes, out of a place called Thurlow, which is one of many B-17 bases in England. Thurlow is about a little town about 10 miles from Oxford, which is about 40, 50 miles northwest of London.
And this is the 306th Bomb Group. And having come in after all these planes had been flying for a while, something tells me you didn't get to dub your plane or paint any nose art on it or give it a name. It was probably already done for you, huh?
No, I never had an airplane of my own. Every mission I flew with a different crew. Sometimes I sat in the right seat, sometimes in the left. The day I got shot down, I was in the left seat, and the pilot of this crew sat in the right seat. And it was unfortunate. This was his 25th mission, and he never survived it. He's the only one in the crew that didn't.
Wow. We're going to get that whole story, and I'll see if I can dig a little bit on the other missions, too, with 93-year-old Robert Farwell, originally from Duluth, Minnesota, but a longtime resident of Bakersfield, California, and for a while, an involuntary resident of Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany. What better way to mark Independence Day weekend and the freedom that we as Americans enjoy by listening to someone who experienced the opposite of freedom as a prisoner of war nearly 70 years ago? More of Hometown Heroes right after this. Have you ever been on a submarine? And hanging out with Nemo at Disneyland doesn't count. How about a World War II submarine preserved just as it was in 1945? Well, here's your opportunity, thanks to the Wahoo Base Submarine Veterans. On Saturday, July 13th, you can tour the World War II sub USS Pompanito, part of the San Francisco Maritime Museum. I'm planning to be on the bus, but more importantly, we'll have veterans on the bus who actually served on subs just like the Pompanito. It's a chance to experience history in a very unique way, and you'll also have 5 hours on your own in San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf area. The bus will leave Fresno at 7 a.m. on July 13th, 0700 for you veterans. We'll roll back into Fresno at approximately 9 p.m. or 2100. Ready to reserve your seat? Call Ted Dick at 559-834-2191. That's 559-834-2191. You can't see a World War II sub every day, so let's go explore some history together July 13th.